This is Mae Brussel. This is the second half of broadcast number 760, and it's very important to keep in mind how many people are hanging over trees or hanging in prisons or dropping dead on the event of some very special occasions, and we better start adding this up. The back deaths as well as what happens in the future, and today things are happening very quickly. Just a few more items on the ways to kill. The New York Times, June 11th, 1978, described a drug called Succinyl, S-U-C-C-I-N-Y-L, chlorine, that was given to a woman. It's supposed to be a muscle relaxant, but there's no evidence of the crime and no traces, and it's impossible to determine the cause of the death. She died of this, and the medical examiner could find no cause, and then it was discovered that this had been given to her, and she went to Harlem Hospital and died, and this administered to her, and it passed the doctor's eyes completely. The magazine Gung Ho, March 83, has an article on how to hide your traces when you're going to kill somebody, and it has an article, when you move there, don't leave any leaf, no footprint, no scent tracks, and its instructions on how to bury every clue or key so your adversary and the enemies won't interpret what you do, and no individual can detect or interpret the signs. Now, Franklin Camber in Alabama and Soldier of Fortune and these various gung-ho activists have ways to teach and train, and they publish a lot of material. I'm just running through a little bit of it on how not to leave those traces. So if Timothy Lee is hanging and over a tree, or Jacqueline Peters is hanging, they know how to disturb the environment and leave away any trace, so nothing is left but the body there and not these big heavy footprints which people think should be there, you know, looking, oh yeah, look, here's two footprints, and you know, just two walk away. It's not that obvious. They have courses and they teach people, and this one particular article I have from Gung Ho is all about that subject. It's called Survival Basic Evasion, and the whole thing is about how to kill and not be discovered, and the security practices to ensure that when things are inspected, there's no litter, there's no personal articles, there's no odor, and how you protect yourself and get away, and you're not linked to those particular murders. And also, if somebody goes to the coroner, from the coroner to the medical examiner, to see what these mystery deaths are, the medical examiners are so corrupt, many of them, and I've cited some from Los Angeles and New York and Houston, Texas, and on the various broadcasts. I haven't done enough on that either. There's so many articles. There's an article a long time ago, and I cite this for a particular reason. This is out of the New York Times. Inquiry by state on Dr. Gross finds medical lapses. And this is the medical examiner from New York City who was at La Costa, California with the mafia when he gave instructions on the telephone to cremate Nelson Rockefeller, the man who was removed to assure Ronald Reagan's New York GOP votes and the presidency for the GOP. Dr. Gross was charged in New York City by the crime's chief medical examiner. They accused him. He's the city, pardon me, their chief medical examiner. They accused him of improperly failing to determine the manner of death in four people that were taken in custody where they were homicides, and that he passed over the fact that they were homicides and that bullets were involved, and these were allegedly natural causes. And there was a lot of scandal about that. And in the course of looking up a few hundred ways to kill at the CIA, and I'm not going to put any more on at this time, I came across the article, the New England Medical Journal of July 1975, that many people asked me for, and the source I'd put away in various places like Chile and so forth. This is about a chemical called cyclophosphamide, C-Y-C-L-O, cyclo, P-H-O-S, cyclophos, P-H-A-M-I-D-E, famide. Okay, cyclophosphamide. New England Medical Journal, July 1975. It was in the Earth News, October 29th, 1975. It was in the London Observer. The point of it was that shots of this particular chemical were given to prisoners in Chile by Mr. Pinochet and the powers that be and the dictatorship, because when they were released from prison, they were cleared, you know, and given, you could say, their tetanus shots or whatever they need. And the point of the article was that this particular ailment would cause their bladders to shrivel up and eventually cease functioning, and they would die a few years later on the outside and not attribute their death to being in the prison. They were released and then could die at home, and the government would not be blamed for their deaths. Now, I want to go now swing now to another subject, two subjects, one quickly and not too much about Senator East, who died allegedly, San Francisco Chronicle says, from a carbon monoxide poisoning. The interesting thing about this subject, I think, is that East was coming home for, I guess, the 4th of July weekend. His family wasn't there. He's confined to a wheelchair, has polio. Nobody was at home. No companion was with him when a man's in this condition. And then the San Francisco Chronicle and Washington Post said East's last appointment, Washington, was Friday afternoon when he met at the Hart Building office with Judge Antonio Scalia to discuss Scalia's nomination to the Supreme Court. East, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, would have voted for the nomination. East returned home to Alexandria, Virginia Friday, then drove to Greenville. His wife was visiting her mother in South Carolina, and so forth. He was home alone, and he was found dead. I think it's interesting that Scalia was visiting East, and take of it what you can. Our future justice of the Supreme Court, who knows what transpired or what happened, but if they were such close friends that he's there in the chambers with him, you'd think that East would at least not commit suicide until maybe 2 weeks later when Scalia is confirmed, because they're such close friends. But we don't know what transpired in that conversation. Now, an event took place out in Beverly Hills, which some of you may or may not have thought was important or interesting, but I think it is to me and to you if we share the information a little bit about the events. There was an article that was published by Jack Anderson when he had his magazine a while back. Remember, Jack had an investigative journal, and in there was an article on the way that events are told in the newspaper before they happen. And I used that material to show how there were hints that John Hinckley would be killing or trying to kill Ronald Reagan in 1981. And this magazine, The Investigator, it's called, came out in September 81 with pictures of ads and information in New Yorker magazine that paralleled events seriously to the bombing attack at Pearl Harbor. And it could have been used by the Japanese to inform each other. And the FBI was aware of this and was working on what was printed in the newspaper. And I've seen, as I do my research and read all these papers, hints of things that happened that at the time you can't save everything. And then later, in fact, there are connections. Now, one of those connections was Newsweek, March 23rd, 1986. It is a picture of Rodeo Drive. And the title is Trouble on Paradise Alley. Rodeo Drive is down but not out in Beverly Hills. Well, my mother is 92 and not well, and I've been going down to Beverly Hills almost every week or every other week during the week. Rodeo Drive was a bean field when I was growing up there. We'd ride our bikes up and down there. But I pass by there and go to Beverly Drive and walk into Beverly. I've never seen Trouble on Paradise Alley. And this caught my eye because Newsweek was saying right there, Trouble, and there's a street sign at Dayton and Rodeo Drive, suggesting that there would be trouble. Now, Dayton, if you look at your Newsweek, is the corner where Van Cleef and Arpels is, where this shootout is going to take place in Beverly Hills. Newsweek, March 24th, the same Newsweek that had the picture of Jodie Foster the week before John Hinckley used her as excuse for shooting Ronald Reagan. You see Dayton Drive and Rodeo Drive, and that's exactly the corner of Van Cleef and Arpels. Trouble on Paradise Alley. Now, another article, a large article in the New York Times, March the 13th, just several days apart. But again, it seemed funny, you know, this is a Rodeo Drive issue, too much glitter. Well, then they have a street map from Santa Monica Boulevard, and my folks live just two blocks north of Santa Monica and about six blocks to the left. And down the bottom is Van Cleef and Arpels. And they have the Beverly Wilshire Hotel in this little map in the New York Times with a little square. And then there's just one business. It's a triangle, Beverly Wilshire Hotel's on a slant, and Van Cleef and Arpels. If you look at your New York Times, March 13th, you see the map of Rodeo Drive, the Beverly Hills Hotel, and Van Cleef and Arpels. And I don't know why that's an issue. Too much glitter. There's Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, Madison Avenue. and the European houses, streets and avenues of London and Paris and in Florida and all over the world. And being as I'm down there, I don't know what all the trouble is or what in the world they were talking about. In fact, there's on Rodeo Drive a place that has foreign newspapers, and I pick up the London Times and various newspapers there, and there's no commotion or trouble. Why were they printing this? Well, then right after that, June 23rd, these two articles, which I happened to save because I guess I was suspicious or feeling something. And then in June, 2 months later, there is a hostage taking, and the San Francisco Chronicle and the LA Times had stories. I'm signing the Chronicle now. Hostage sees suspect wanted in Nevada. Now, a person, Stephen Livadidis, Livadidis, was wanted for a burglary in Las Vegas, in Nevada. He was suspected. He cleaned out $250,000 worth of jewelry, and this bandit was given 5 years. He escaped from jail, which is bad because there's harsh penalties for escaping. He was recaptured. Then his sentence was suspended sentence. And studying and working with the prisoners in California, I knew the circumstances by which people were left on the outside and not given their charges of 5 or 10 or 20 years if they would do a favor in return. So he was out on a suspended sentence. Now, Nancy Reagan, the first lady, who usually travels with her husband unless she has some other business, is sitting at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel about one block away, both of them identified in the New York Times on that particular article. She's in the Beverly Hills Hotel watching television at the shootout, and the article says she's very familiar with the store. It changed names. It used to be Reusser's, R-U-S-E-R, and it became Van Cleef & Arpels. But that's where Ronald Reagan bought her wedding ring. So she's one block away watching the shootout at a store that she and Ronnie go to. And another article in the newspaper describes the situation of the manager of the store, who was, in fact, murdered, and he was very familiar with Frank Sinatra and other persons, and I'll go into that in one moment. But the slain, what happened was that a man comes to the store, this robber from Vegas who's on probation and who was sentenced already, and he approaches inside the store, locked up at 10, right open as Hugh Skinner. This San Francisco Chronicle says, slain store manager, elegant and discreet. And if you see a picture of this Livadidis and Hugh Skinner, you know the difference. One is very worldly, well-known in Beverly Hills, well-known in Hollywood, and to the people who were the in crowd, that group, and he was one of the hostages who died in the siege. He opens the door and lets this fellow in, the one from Vegas, home state of Paul Exald and Frank Sinatra, very close to the Reagans and the Bloomingdales and Vicky Morgan, and this is what I'm leading to. He opens the store, Mr. Skinner, and the newspaper said Skinner himself may have escorted Livadidis into Van Cleef & Arpels Monday morning. There were three employees in the store. Two were shot, and then the store manager, Hugh Skinner, was not shot, and Skinner was taken outside of the store. Now, Livadidis may have been told to take him out. He didn't kill him. He had killed the other two. And what he does, he leaves the store and goes in front where he has two remaining people alive tied to him. Actually three, Skinner and two others. And he has these hostages around him, and there's 17 helicopters above, and the police in Beverly Hills usually are every 4 inches apart. So maybe they're an inch apart now, surrounding this corner triangle, so there's nowhere to go. It's a corner street, and there's just no way he can get past. And the police department, the SWAT team, the same SWAT team that killed the six people of the SLA and cremated them, the SWAT team killed the store owner, and they were very open about it. And in the San Francisco Chronicle, June 26, it says, the hostage slaying a mistake, not an accident. The Deputy George Johnson, 42, a member of the police SWAT team, the Special Weapons Unit, said that he killed one of the three hostages with a would-be robber, and they said it's not an accidental shot, Sheriff Sherman Block said. There was adequate illumination in the parking lot to get a clear sighting when he hit the person he aimed at, and the person he aimed at was the manager of the store. Now, the newspaper accounts tell how he sold to so many prominent people. He sold to Frank Sinatra, to Willie Shoemaker, to Cary Grant, Jerry Lewis, and so forth. And then the article says many men would buy their wives, their secretaries, their girlfriends, the same thing. You would never tell. Now, the keeper of the secrets, Hugh Skinner, from Van Cleef & Arpels, the shop of the Reagans, Sinatra, and so forth, is taken out on the street and killed by the SWAT team with enough light aimed at him, not the guy who went into the store, and he is dead. Nancy has not come to California or on vacation with Ronnie. She could wait and come out with him. Usually they do. She's out there alone, and she's watching this at a place where her friends shop. Now, what I'm wondering is that if this was a way similar to the way the mafia leaves dead bodies on the street so you know what happened, and the symbolism of wiping people out, is this a way for them to know those people that have blackmailed them? See, hanging over the Reagans are the stories and the photos that are not destroyed of the cabinet, suggested Edwin Meese, the attorney general, the sex parties, Vicky Morgan, the Alfred Bloomingdale stories. These are the people that send jewelry to their wives and to their mistresses. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of things going on in Hollywood continuously. And this crowd, this particular shop, goes directly to relationships into the White House. And the First Lady sat there at the telly and watched it, just as William Graham sat at a telly in Washington and watched the Challenger blow up that day when he had written the speech for the president that night. Now, Vicky Morgan had her head cracked open, and of course, people aren't talking. If they have the tapes, we don't know where they are. There have been a lot of strange things, and as soon as her head was split with a baseball bat, that ended the subject. The person allegedly who killed her without any fingerprints on the baseball bat, the patsy, Marvin Pancoast, is in a California prison in Vacaville dying of AIDS. Larry Flint was one of the people who wanted to handle her, claimed he had seen the pictures. The former he's still a publisher of Hustler. He's trying to sell it. He was taunting the president, tantalizing them. As a matter of fact, he had called me and said he had these pictures. What should he do with them? And he was telling about the intrigue. I said they wanted him to put some kind of dye or lie on them. And if they did, then they would prosecute in return this Joseph Franklin, who had paralyzed Larry Flynn and tried to kill him, or just to paralyze him and hurt him. That was supposed to be the deal. Well, I suggest to Larry Flynn that you get rid of them entirely. Don't have anything to do with them, because nothing comes but death or destruction. And I think you know I documented what happened to Larry Flynn and his family on World Watchers each week as it was coming down. When I was in his home, Althea, his wife, came up to me, and she was with Dennis Hopper, the movie director, and they were about to make a movie on Jim Morrison. And she said, I don't believe your stories about the rock musicians being killed. And she also wanted to make one on Jimi Hendrix. And she was just sneering at me. She didn't say, I'm glad to know you. I think your work is interesting, and so forth. So that's all I had to say to her. And she just walked away, and I didn't see her again. And then about a month or two later, you remember Gordon Novell of Permandex of the Defense Department moved into their house, and Mitchell Werbel of the CIA and the Defense Department, and G. Gordon Liddy of the FBI, the CIA and the Defense Department, and Timothy Leary. And Althea was taken off to Cedars-Sinai Hospital, where they had administered drugs to her and got her back on drugs, where she had kicked the habit, had started taking them with Larry after he'd been shot. Well, I understand, I talked to Paul Krasner in Los Angeles and Art Kunkin, the former publisher of the LA Free Press, who worked, both of them worked for Larry Flynn. And they told me that Althea Flint is dying of AIDS now and has the same disease as Marvin Pancoast. And the brother-in-law of Jim Morrison, who became Larry Flint's bodyguard and was with Jim Morrison when he died, can be assured there's not going to be a movie about Jim Morrison, and there's not going to be one about Jimi Hendrix. Another close associate of theirs that I linked to the Alfred Bloomingdale, Vicky Morgan scandals was Roy Gone, also simultaneously part of Western Goals with the late Larry McDonald and Edward Teller and Eugene Wigner from the Atomic Energy, one of the first daddies of the atomic bomb, and Admiral Moore, this military group that have computers into police departments. Roy Cohn, the associate of Alfred Bloomingdale, and Vicky Morgan in the kinky sex group, is now dying of cancer. They say it's AIDS. So that is the tale of what happens to people who get involved in things or know too much. And I think that the allowing this man on probation and allowing him into a store that he must have had the word to go ahead, like he was going to pick up jewelry made for someone in Vegas, killing the two people and walking out with the manager of the store, Mr. Skinner, who sells to this very crowd, while the madam, like the madam knew, sits there in her hotel, or Imelda Marcos, sits at the Beverly Hills Hotel one block away and watches it. And the very police department SWAT teams that were used in Beverly Hills to bring in Elmer Davis and put him in jail for 3 years for the White House burglary that turned out to be E. Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy's burglary, that same Beverly Hills police shot Skinner on the street and then are arrogant enough to say in the news accounts, it was not an accident. And then they said there was adequate illumination. We shot him. If you couldn't tell the difference between you, Skinner, you know, this suave Beverly Hills jeweler from one of the finest stores in the United States, to that motley guy that looks something like Charles Manson, if the SWAT team can't tell the difference, heaven help us, and there's no apologies or excuses for those people. That's the same SWAT team that helped out Ronald Wiggin and Ed Meese by killing the SLA in Los Angeles, beginning their domestic terrorism. And so Nancy is sitting there. I think it's very important the way power moves, and you can't underestimate what looked like a little vignette of a shootout with the first lady down the corner where Ronnie, you know, had gone in there, and knowing the people and their friends buying from this particular jeweler and using the Beverly Hills police, it has a lot of meaning. And also the picture of the street sign corner the very 2 months before in Newsweek, and the map of the hotel and the jewelry corner in the New York Times preceding the event are similar to the other articles I've read that indicate what is happening. Now, the Reagans are having other problems, or interesting things are happening to them, which also affect us. And I do think that shootout in Beverly, follow the trial, could have some implications, depending on how far people catch on or want to go. Last week, the president had a very disturbing relapse or lapse of memory at the press conference, and he explained when he was speaking to reporters in Oklahoma City, he said, "I do that often," and he shot back that "I've lost my mind for a moment. I do it often," and this is what he was explaining, and we got a sample of that with his press conference. Now, the San Francisco Chronicle had an article that it was in the economic section of the Cron, saying that the stock market dropped, and this didn't get much headline, when they believed that Ronald Reagan was going to die or sick. And I don't know how many of you saw it in your newspapers or followed the market, but June 14th, there was an article, "Reagan Rumor, Profit Takers Trip Up on the Dows," attributed to a rumor that Reagan was ill despite the White House assurances. It affected the stock market because there was this rumor. Now, I want to just share with you a very well-written and brilliant article by Alexander Coburn. This was in These Times, sent to me by a listener to World Watchers, June 25th, 1986. Very important. There's a picture of Ronald Reagan completely out of focus. I have a good friend who describes with me that Ronald Reagan is like the picture of Dorian Gray, that he's going to all fall apart some way. But this is what Alexander Coburn says, and it exemplifies what is America, what is happening, as against what we think we perceive. It's titled "Out to Lunch and Dinner." In the wake of President Reagan's June 11th news conference, the media once again faced the problem how to deal with the fact that the commander-in-chief, the great communicator, the leader of the free world, was not merely out to lunch, but appeared to have absented himself from all subsequent repasts. Reagan, for those unfortunate enough to have missed the display, was glassy-eyed, slack-jawed, almost entirely incoherent. Among other disasters, he had not bothered to watch the news that evening. He was therefore unaware of the Supreme Court vote, 5-4, upholding the constitutional right to abortion. When asked a question about the decision, he plunged into a prepared response, and this is usually prepared response, about the earlier court decision on Baby Doe. It's true that not one journalist inconvenienced the president with an inquiry about the South African crisis, but many questions were pointed. The ritual known as presidential press conference is an important avenue to advance your career, and people were standing trying to get questions to him. Later, they began asking about the SALT Treaty. Reagan lunged this way and that, contradicting himself at every turn, and concluded by telling Leslie Stahl of CBS that maybe if the Russians straighten out their act, the U.S. would stick with SALT after all. Now, many of you have seen that in the news, but the important thing about this article is the way Coburn writes it up. He says, next day, a straightforward battle for power between the elected president of the United States and the invisible government of the United States, represented by White House spokesman Larry Speaks. Speaks announced flatly that notwithstanding what the president had said the previous night, U.S. no longer would be bound by the provisions of SALT. Now, I began my first published article in 1972, the one Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped, saying there are two governments, one that exists, the visible, they exist side by side, and that glimpses of the invisible government were beginning to appear through the Watergate story. There were other glimpses, but the Watergate story would show you the power structure and the one that really rules it behind the power structure, the visible, invisible government. So Alexander Coburn is describing here that you have your elected president, then you're invisible, and it's represented by Speaks. And when a president says something, and you see this more and more, he comes in and says, no, that's not what he said. And Speaks talks with the National Security Agency and the Pentagon so that no matter what the president says, the course is the same. He can't sit and say something, and that's very important. They determine what he said, even if he said something else. When they have the last word, that is what he said, and that is what it holds. The article goes on, the president struck back, telling school children at lunch that the SALT II treaty was not dead. But in the late afternoon, the handlers had closed in, and the president admitted defeat. I looked at the network news program to see hardly any comment on it. ABC's Sam Donaldson did recount the amusing to-and-fro SALT story, but without any larger reflection of the president's mental speech. Just that it wasn't dead, it is dead, it wasn't, and now it is. But nothing about his mental state that caused this. NBC with Marvin Kalb, and remember, Kalb is a protege of Kissinger, traveled with Kissinger. Bernard Kalb and Marvin Kalb are part of Kissinger Associates mentality under Fritz Kramer. Marvin Kalb on NBC used as a diversionary the Seymour Hersh story in the New York Times. Under the supervision, helping write this story was George Shultz of the State Department, William Casey of the CIA. It was against President Noriega of Panama, accusing him of drug smuggling, selling arms and intelligence. And Alexander Coburn says that the purpose of this, going to Noriega at this time, which they obviously knew about for a long, long time, was to divert the attention from the Contras, from the vote, from the drug smuggling, to divert attention from embarrassing disclosures about the drug activities of the U.S.-backed Nicaraguans, and also the arrest of Theodore Shackley and a lot of their team members. And then he goes on to say, a UPI story said the president was aware that he put up a poor showing at the press conference, that he had been trying to call on new people, and the added mental burden had done him in. Now, the fact that he can reach to somebody and say, you, and that does him in, shows the mental state of the president at this time. Now, I'm wondering if that mental state has anything to do with medication he's getting when he has the polyps removed, or whether it has something to do at this time with Nancy being out in California when this operation was taking place in a surrounding they were familiar with, and was there something there which they had to eliminate or warn people about visibly on the streets to get the matter clear and keep it hidden? I assure you, the Vicky Morgan, Alfred Bloomingdale, Meese Reagan tapes will be out someday, get out someday. They can keep killing people and silencing people, and this poor Skinner, the jeweler, would know who got the jewelry, where it was sent, if these particular people in his administration are sending it to other men, if they're homosexuals, if they have mistresses, who they are. There's a lot of activity on that street, at that corner. The First Lady was there. The president was fumbling his lines. This is a man who still controls Congress to get them to change their mind on the votes, can change the courts of the United States, make it so far right you won't know it. This is what John Mitchell promised We're in a state with a madman. He's attacked by the world court. It doesn't matter. He will push his mediocre, dangerous right-wing appointments and steer this country, and the attention should be given to Ronald Reagan, not so much his appointees, but to his mind. And I understand Ramsey Clark has written up a list of suggestions of impeachment. We ought to move fast and at the same time work on George Bush's relationship to the murder of Orlando Letelier, and in return the same people murdering Olof Palme in Sweden. It's time to get to these people who are doing these murders based on a lot of evidence before they turn this whole system against us and hang more people on trees, which part of their members have promised to do from coast to coast. Well, this is May Brussel. It may be the land of the free, 30 or 40 million spent on celebrating Statue of Liberty, but inside the country from shore to shore, there are a lot of problems that have to be met before we're going to be free. Meanwhile, thanks again for the books and articles. I'll be back with you next week. Take care. This is Mae Brussel, and how can I say it? Thank you for all the material you're sending and also for what you're sharing with me.